This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Good morning, ladies. We get back to Sarah. Are there any questions before I go back to Sarah on last week or recent week? Okay, we've got to analyze why that is happening, because you're asking the questions a little deeper than that. You're really asking a why question. Also, why is it in this profession, as opposed to all other professions, the focus is only on the drudgery, as if it were the end in itself, and there is no recognition of the outcome. And the outcome is life, and the outcome is educated children, and so on. And I think that you're putting your finger on a very, very serious problem, and that is that the outcome stuff, the glamorous stuff, the non-routine stuff, is the part that women have delegated. The part they somehow doggedly hang on to is the dieters in the kitchen. And the part that they have delegated is education and trying to get out of every opportunity to spend time with the children. I'm not talking about all women. I'm talking about a lot of mothers. So what are they doing? Now that do you know how many mothers, including my own wife, I've heard say, summer vacation, I don't know what I'm going to do with them. Instead of saying, my goodness, at last I've got them. For 2.5 months, I can impact on them. I haven't heard one mother say, I've been waiting for this, so that for these 2 days I can get into the glamour stuff. I can create people. I'm going to spend my entire day with these kids. I've just heard the mothers and I understand it, but one has to understand where it's coming from, saying, oh, you know, 2.5 months, what does one do? So you get camps. You carry on delegating. You've got them now for 2.5 months, so what do? We hire other people during these 2.5 months to take them away. So I said the women are doing it themselves, not society. Instead of women saying, I'm not going to do the routine stuff, I want to be educating my child. I want to be fresh. When my child comes back from school, I don't really drain from cleaning dishes. I'm going to hire somebody else to do that. So when my child comes back from school, I can spend an hour with the kid, playing with the kid, talking to the kid. Then I can start doing homework with the kid in a way where I can bring my angle and my perspective into the child. That would start the process of glamorizing what a housemaker really is. So I think we're caught in a trap where there is such a burden, and where women themselves have allowed themselves to be caught up in that. But the only way they can escape the drudgery is through a career. So now you've got women who are involved in drudgery and women who are involved in careers. But very few women who celebrate and glamorize the job of creating a home rather than creating a house.
Well, I was just going to say that also in terms of the housekeeping part of that, creating a home.
A focus, you put on, in other words, if you put all your efforts into preparing the Shabbos meal, so by the time the Shabbos meal is ready, you are unable to participate in the, then of course you're highlighting the drain. And so if one listens in sometimes to the messages that mothers give out to their daughters, and again, by no means everybody, one has some very wonderful messages coming through as well, but one often hears the, oh, it's Shabbos again, back to the kitchen Friday again. So one gets a reinforcement of the message that this is a drudge. And the message then is that the escape from the drudgery is a career. And that's one escape from the drudgery, but there is another escape from the drudgery, and that is to delegate, as one does in the office, to delegate all of that stuff, as much of it as one can, so that one is free and fresh to be doing the things that are more glamorous. Then, one's not going to delegate at all, there's still going to be, obviously, but then there's the possibility of looking at the drudgery as the practicing the scales, because it's only to get to the outcome. But right now there isn't outcome. When the outcome is there, when the concert pianist comes onto that stage, the audience doesn't see the tired, drained guy who's been up all night, and you guys here again to hear some playing. Don't you understand? I was up all night practicing. I really don't feel like playing for you, but okay, here it is. They don't feel that. They feel that here's somebody who's been doing lying in the sun all day, and that's part of the act. That's part of the art. Does a child, when he comes home, feel that my mother's been lying around all day waiting for me? Does the family coming home on a Friday night from shul feel, here's my mother, she's been in the beauty parlor all Friday, where she belongs? That's where she should be on Friday, not in the kitchen. According to halacha, that's where she should be. She should be in the beauty parlor on Friday, and she should have maids in the kitchen. And when they come home and there she is ready to entertain and to add sparkle and beauty to it, of course she's stage managed the whole thing and she's planned and the home and the table and the food is exactly as she's planned it, not as some delegated person has planned it. And she doesn't have to be the one who's cut her fingers and is tearing, whose eyes are tearing. She needs to be. Now, if she were doing that, then people wouldn't be focusing on the drudgery. They wouldn't see the drudgery. The importance of art, or one of the important elements of art, is that the drudgery is not evident to the viewer. You must look at a poem and look at it as if this, you know, the beautiful, as we saw it in South Africa, I don't know if it ever showed here, for Amstel Beer. It was so beautiful. You see this man sitting over, looking over the lakes of England and writing on a piece of it, on a pad with a quill, and he writes something like, you know, he writes something like, I was lonely, and he scratches it out, and he writes, I was walking in a lonely way, and he scratches it out, and it goes on and on like this, and then there's this bottle of Amstel beer, and he takes a slug of his Amstel beer, and he looks up and he writes, I wandered lonely as a cloud. So the poem is supposed to look as if he just sat down one day and said, oh, how beautiful. Yeah, my little sonnet. You're not supposed to see the scratchings out and the revisions and the counting up the meters and the checking the rhyming and changing a word because it's just not quite right. You're not supposed to see all that. You're supposed to see it look spontaneous. And too much of what we see in our women is the drudgery. The and one understands it. But is this bad management? Or is this somehow a misguided belief that that's what I'm supposed to be doing? And sure, we're not going to be celebrating the fact that the glamour of it. That's not what we're seeing. So I think you're touching on something that's so important and so deep that the responsibility for it, I think, is at the women's door. It might start at education and society and all sorts of things. But women need to say, this is not what being a woman is about. This is artistry, and I'm not...
I think part of
that if you want to look at the total picture, that's the benefit side, is to look at the anti-glamour. The cost side is the same thing, business situation as well. You're drudging away, but when you go to your client, the client sees none of the drudge. The client sees sparkle and energy and smiling, and that's just the client know what you've been through to try and prepare for that meeting, and the deadlines you've been trying to meet, and the sleep you didn't go without, and the worry you've had, and that thing, you can't. But the woman would have to come across like that if she wants the glamour side to be recognized. At the moment, it's almost a guilt. When you sit down at the Shabbos table, finally, it's almost guilt on the part of the family. You know, gee, did my mother have to go through all of this? I have kids sometimes saying, you know, Robert, use paper and get some takeaway or open a can of beans and be relaxed. That's more important to us. And somehow the women tend to focus on a lot of the drudgery to produce magnificence. That was sometimes the soul is gone because she's gone in the process of doing that. And there's a balancing act here that I don't think women have got right. I think women have got far less right than not men, but the working world. I mean, the working world has got it right. And I think the artistic world has got it right. And women have not brought homemaking and family building into the realm of art and business, profession.
I think it's very complex in a sense. And also very, very challenging, and perhaps even more challenging than interacting with adults, to on an even basis interact consistently with children. And it's easier in some ways to delegate someone else to go get the dress and you make breakfast.
Much easier.
And then to be consciously aware, no, someone else can wash dishes, I'll get the dress. Someone else, you know, go to the market, I'll take them to school. And to constantly delegate.
Easier to wash dishes.
It really is.
It's much easier. It's therapeutic.
But for the right here now, it's easier. And so there's a tendency to go drift toward it. But when one does keep that bigger perspective, one constantly has to say to themselves, this is where I need to spend my time.
And then there's the counterbalance of that. The washing the dishes, and we're just using that as an image, but a lot of the stuff is in a sense therapeutic because it's saying, you know, this guy is focusing on something. And there's a meeting, you've done it, it's done, you've done your work and finished. It's that looking after the kids is not only looking after the kids is not only challenging, but it's also draining. And you land up spending, especially if you've got little kids, communicating on the level of small kids, and at the same time you've got to be able to communicate on an equal as an equal to your husband, who has been communicating with adults all day. So there's that thing that has to be managed. The woman somehow, although she's involved with kids, has to be able to retain her adult growth and development so that she doesn't cease to be a companion to him. She's now a good mother, but she's no longer a wife. There's that balancing act that needs to be done. And the way the Torah requires that done again is by dedicating a lot of the drudgery, the time that she would be putting into the drudgery, she should be putting into self-development. Through a career of her own, or through work of her own, or reading or development of her own. So the balancing really should be between children and self-development. The housework is the last thing that's important. It's the least important of all. Because that anybody can do. True, economically that's not always easy, but it should certainly be a priority in a family to make sure that somebody else does do that. Because that's the thing that's most easily delegated. The cooking, the washing, the laundry, all of that can most easily be delegated. What the wife then should be focusing on is that balance between being able to relate and develop her children and being able simultaneously to relate to her husband and develop that relationship. Because if those two aren't moving, and that should be where her total fulfillment comes from in the home environment. And that's those are the two parts that are being neglected in the tremendous drudgery. And this is an incredibly big problem, and I think must be responsible for a lot of unhappiness in women and in marriages as well. Sorry.
I'm
the
difficulty is that it's not
true. That's interesting. There's not that much feedback. There's much more feedback from producing a nice meal. It's immediate also, and people say thank you, and beautiful and delicious.
Yeah.
But it's not the same. You're at the background, you're busy, and you're right. The credit is almost. It's got to be inner. Anything else in terms of the in terms of difficulties with what we're learning? Okay, does the Monday night question relate to any of this? Let me try and move through this quickly, because we're now going to be leaving it for several weeks. Sorry?
We can't ask anything now about Monday night.
Not if it's not relevant. I don't know what to do. Would you rather ask the questions? Would you rather learn the thing? Otherwise, I think we're better off.
Okay. Thank you.
Hashem pakadet Sarah kasher amar. But we're told Hashem now visits Sarah as he undertook. She has a baby. Perek Kafal, at the beginning of 21. And Abraham calls the name of the child born to him by Sarah, Yitzchak. That's the name he gives. And we're going to look at this. Yitzchak means laughter, means will laugh. There will be laughter. And we're going to look at the meaning of the word Yitzchak. It comes in several times in the next few sentences, this laughter issue. Vayomul Avram is Yitzchak beno bet shmonas yomim. Avram gives his son a bris at 8 days old. The first time a bris was carried out at 8 days. Yishmael was 13 when he was brised, and Avraham was nearly 100 when he was brised. This was the first child that was brised at the age of 8, and that's why the Muslims still today do their circumcisions at 13, following the tradition of Yishmael. Avraham ben Ma'ashana. So that bris at 8 days is a very important statement for us. That's what differentiates us. It's not the circumcision that differentiates us. The Arabs also circumcised. Yishmael was also circumcised. Lots of people do. What differentiates is that 8th day. That has the meaning. And the meaning of that 8th day is that firstly, by eight days the child has experienced the Shabbos. It's the first opportunity that of course the child might have experienced the Shabbos the second day or the third day, but by 8 days all children have experienced the Shabbos. The child comes into the covenant having participated already, or having experienced on its level Shabbos. Secondly, that's the age at which an animal could be considered for sacrifice. Until 8 days the animal wasn't considered yet complete, so the 8th day is when the child is first complete. 8 is also the supernatural. 7 is not supernatural in the sense of witchcraft and spiritualism and all that, but supernatural in terms of going beyond nature. 7 is nature, 8 is going beyond nature. Circumcision is unnatural. Natural is to leave the baby just as he was created. Circumcision is putting our own imprint on the child and participating in the act of creation, continuing the act of creation, going beyond nature. Nature is our starting point. Nature is not our end point. One of the problems with environmentalism mentioned, with a lot of the emphasis today on nature and natural remedies and natural this and natural this and natural that, that's all fine if that's a starting point. That's not an end point. And as the environmentalist society is beginning to view that as an end point, and that's problematic. If by pursuing a certain policy that is providing homes for people and jobs for people and income for supporting vast amounts of people, the spotted owl is going to disappear from the forests of Oregon, well, that's very sad that people can befall the spotted owl. If there's any way we can save the spotted owl as well, then we should try and save the spotted owl. But to put vast resources into the spotted owl and leave the people unemployed, that's not okay. Nature is a starting point, it's not an end point. And yes, we have to preserve nature as much as we can as we go along. We have to be careful not to destroy nature as far as we can. That's prohibited. Even destroying a fruit tree, we know, is against the din. If you take down one fruit tree, you have to plant another fruit tree. Wiping out a species is against the law. That's why the bird and the man and the egg at the same time, and the cow and the calf at the same time. Those are all laws to show that the species need as far as possible to be preserved. But this is all to support man, not as an end in itself. And the eighth day business is part of that. 7 days is nature. 8 days, man taking, saying, right, we've got the 7 days, we've got the week. That's nature. Now our job begins. Once nature is established, our job begins. And so he gives him the bris on the eighth day. Avraham ben Ashan abihavaloid lois Yitzchak ben Avraham was 100 years old when Yitzchak was born. But Tomer, and here we have it, so it says, Tzachok Asoli Elokim, literally translated as laughter God has made for me or of me. Kol hashomea Yitzchakli, whoever hears is going to laugh. Vatomer mimi lel Avraham enika vanim sora. Who is this that is would believe that Avraham has had a child at this age, that Sarah is breastfeeding a child at this age, that I gave birth at this age? It's absurd. It's so funny. So she almost basks in the humor of it. It's really, really, it's funny. But the use of the words is interesting. She doesn't say Yitzchak alai, that people will laugh at me. She says Yitzchak li, will laugh for me. What's the difference between laughing at and laughing for? For me. It's like, because to me doesn't make sense. So it's not Yitzchak Olai, which is laugh at me, but it's Yitzchak Li, which means laugh for me. The joy. So it's so interesting that the same word and the same action can be either ridicule or sharing joy, depending on whether it's at or with. So laughter is a very strange thing. Laughter can be incredibly cruel and incredibly kind. Laughter can be amazingly inclusive and it can be completely exclusive. And that part of those elements are in Yitzchak's name. And she says, she's in fact praising God and saying God created laughter. And it's interesting how the Unkelus translates with laughter in this sentence. He translates it chadva, which comes from the Hebrew word which is chedva, which means joy, not laughter. So when she said Tzchok Asar Yekim, she's not saying God has made a joke of me. She's saying God has made me a channel of laughter, joy, celebration. And that I'm praising him for, that people will come and just see this absurdity and not mock at it, but celebrate it. That's what she sees in Yitzchak's name. And that's the joy that she finds in Yitzchak's name. But what in fact happened? Vayigdala Yered Vayigomal, the child grew and was weaned. Vayat Avraham Mishte Godol B'yom Yigomel Es Yitzchok, and Avraham made a great party on the day that Yitzchok was weaned. What is a great party? Rashi says Mishte Godol, a great party. What do you think a great party means without looking at Rashi? Now that's what one imagines a great. Yeah, but that doesn't fit. Avraham, that doesn't fit. That might well have been the case, but to talk about Godol is a word, again, which is such a funny word. You can talk about a big pumpkin and you would use the word Godol, and you could talk about a great musical composer and you would use the word Godol, and you can talk about a great tzaddik and you would use the word Godol. Again, it means big. It's so here. Big can be in...
About
Well, yes, but Rashi says something amazing. Rashi defines that Shehayu Sham Gedolei Hador. The Gedolim were there. The great people of the generation were there. That's a great party. A great party is who it attracts. And as we said on Monday night, you can have lots and lots of people, but if they're the wrong people, it's not a great party. And that's really is who's there determines the greatness of the party, both in terms of the atmosphere of the party and the status of the party, and it's a symptom of what kind of party it is. So who was there? Shem and Aver were there. Shem and Aver were the people who had been teaching Torah as it was at that time from the time of Adam. So the tradition of Adam was being taught all these generations. There was a yeshiva all the way through. There were two yeshivas. There was one by Shem and there was one by Aver, and Abraham himself studied in those yeshivas, and Yitzchak and Yaakov later on studied. Shem and Aver were teaching monotheism and were teaching Derech Eretz and were teaching Menschlichkeit and were teaching the existence of God to a small body of people throughout that period of time. And they were at that party, and Avimelech was at that party, interestingly enough. Plus, says the Gemara, all the kings that Yoshua later killed. So the heads of all the nations, this was a royal party. The kings were there, and the scholars were there. You had Shem and Aver, the thinkers, and you had Avimelech, the king, the royalty was there. It was just, you can imagine what kind of a party that was, with every great thing. This is 2 years later. This is 2 years after the Bris, the weaning, which was at about age two. Now, there's no mention anywhere in the Torah, strangely enough, about any option. Shurin is a hiccup. So why people make these great parties at these hiccups, I haven't a clue. Higamel makes sense, because the child at the point of ceasing to breastfeed, the child is, that's the first level of independence. So that would be, one would understand why that, certainly when breastfeeding took place for 2 years, one would understand why that was a point of the party. The child is now capable of surviving on his own and is established, and that's the beginning of a separation, and there is pain in that separation, as there are in all separations, but there's also joy of the growth and the independence. And that's what they were celebrating. That's an offshoot. Yeah, but that comes later, a little bit later. Were there women at the party? It says all the great people. It says all the great people. You'll see there were women at this party. You'll see right now the very next sentence. Vatere Sora is ben Hagar Hamitzris Asher Yodro Lavrom. And Sora was watching Yishmael at this party. She had an eye on Yishmael, just waiting to see how he was interacting. There was a party. This was hard for Yishmael. He was for so many years, he was the 13 years, he was the king of the household. He was the only son. And Sora was in the background. All of a sudden, there's a baby comes in, and whose child is it? It's Sora's. And Yishmael's whole status starts to change now. And the way he relates to this will determine his relationship with Yitzchak throughout history. This is now going to be very interesting. This is the descendants of Yishmael, the whole Arab world, and the descendants of Yitzchak. And she's watching them at their first real interaction, where there's a competitiveness for the first time. Not that Yitzchak is old enough to be competitiveness, but the very fact of this party creates a competitive environment for Yishmael. So how does Yishmael respond? And the Torah uses one word, Mitzachek. He was laughing. Well, but this is a different, doesn't say laughing with, doesn't say laughing at, it just says Mitzachek, laughing. Well, mitzachek, we said mitzachek olai means laughing at me. Mitzachek li means laughing with me. What does mitzachek mean? Yes, so mitzachek implies a playfulness, a playing. It implies laughing with nobody. So you can laugh at somebody, you can laugh with somebody, and you can laugh in a way that doesn't include anybody at all. And the Gemara says that there are three things, three different views as to what he was doing, what she noticed in him at that time. The one view is, this all comes from a Gemara in Soto, and Ramban works on it quite a lot, and says the one is Shvichus Domim, murder. Why murder? Where's the laughter in murder? And the story is that he was taking little Yitzchak out and saying, let's divide up the territory. There are now two of us.
so there's going to be an inheritance, let's divide it up. I'll shoot an arrow, you go and stand there, and I'll shoot an arrow, and let's see how far the arrow goes, and that's where, and the arrow just misses Yitzchak. And then he says, now go and stand there, and the arrow just misses Yitzchak on the other side. And Sarah sees this, and says, what are you doing? And he says, I'm playing. We're just playing. We're just playing is an excuse that people can use when they're doing deadly things. And she didn't like that. He's 15. And she didn't like him endangering life and calling that playing. That's not playing. And she felt that he was minimizing the value of life. The other view is that she was involved in Avodah Zorah, that he was involved in idolatry. And all these views are supported by the fact that the word mitzachek is used to describe these activities elsewhere. Avodah Zorah, when they danced around the golden calf, it was called mitzachek. They were laughing, they were celebrating. And there too, mitzachek is, in idolatry, you're using religion to entertain, rather than in religion, Torah is not entertaining. There is a legitimate place for entertainment, but Torah is not entertaining. There's nothing entertaining about Torah. It's reality, it's truth, it's confrontation, it's challenge, it's thinking, it's not entertainment. And Avodah Zorah is turning religion into something entertaining, where you are feeling entertained but you're not relating with anything real. There's no real God out there, there's no real object out there that you're interacting with. It's just purely an inward activity. And the third one is Gilui Arayos, where he was pursuing other people's wives, where there's the same thing, as using that as entertainment. So in all those three cases, it was taking the most serious things in life, God, life, and family, and using it for personal entertainment. And that was the mitzachek that she saw. And the Gemara discusses, and some reject those views and say it isn't feasible. But what's really interesting is, once again, the translation of Unkelus, of that word mitzachek. You'll remember earlier he translated it as chagva, as joy. Here he translates it as mechayech. What does mechayech mean? Smile. Just a smile. She watched him, and all she saw in his face was a smile. No idolatry, no immorality, no murder, just a smile.
Smile or a smirk?
Just a smile. Vatomela Avraham, and she says to Avraham in the next sentence, Goreshu Amazo says, but I'll get rid of this woman and her son. That's it. Finished. Because I will not allow the son of this woman to inherit with my son. There's no sharing, there's nothing, just out. That's the end of it. Because he smiled. So if it was idolatry or murder or immorality, one begins to understand. But if it was just a smile, what's the difficulty with that, and what is he smiling at? The Mephoshim bring two things. The one thing is, the Radak says, Ki ilu mal igal Yitzchak shenoylod miskenim. A smile that he's the son of such old people. What's so terrible about that? We get some idea of it in the Sipurnu. It says the following: Mal igal hamishte shenase beveis Avram. He was laughing at the party. He was smiling at the party, and the look on his face was, "This is such a farce." Why? Ba'omro shenis Avram Avimelech. He went around saying Avimelech is the father. Not Avram.
Who's
the father? Yishmael. Don't you know that Sarah was alone with Avimelech 9 months ago? And it was 9 months previously. And later on, there was an amazing resemblance in Yitzchok to Avram. And in fact, he was almost identical to his father. And Chazal say that was a kindness to Avram, because Yishmael started a rumor which never disappeared, that Avimelech was the father. And it only disappeared when people saw that Yitzchok was the splitting image of his father, of Avram. But until that time, Yishmael had set that rumor in motion, and he was doing it here. That was the smile that she saw, and she linked it to what he was saying. So why the complete rejection? There's no tshuva, there's no repentance, there's no repairing of it, there's no rebuke, there's just get her up and get the son up. Completely up. And we see Avram was not happy with it. The next sentence says, Vayera hadovo, ma'oiz be'enei Avram. And this matter was very, very bad for Avram. He was very uncomfortable about it. Alolos b'no, because of his son. And there's a lot of discussion, which we don't have time to get into. What was so bad? was losing Hagar the problem, was losing the son the problem, was losing them both the problem, was why was he, and he delayed, he didn't want to do this. Until God said to Avram, Al yero b'enecho al anar v'al amosecho, do not worry about the boy and your maidservant, kol asher tomare lecho soro shma b'kilo, whatever Soro tells you do, ki v'yitzchok yikore lecho Zora, because your future is with Yitzchok, not with Ishmael. V'gamet b'enu amar l'goy asimenu, however, the son of the maidservant will also become a great nation. Ki zarachohu, because he is also your child. So he also has a future, but it's not tied to your future. Your future is with Yitzchok. So she's right, go ahead and do it. But what is it that gives Sora the right and is then supported by God for this complete rejection through one action of Ishmael?
Well, the maidservant. Why does God call Hagar the maidservant?
Because from now on that's what she's going to be. That's the, I want to see her as that, because this isn't working. The role has been filled. She's the mother of a nation, but to you she's your maidservant. She's not your wife. Sora is your wife and Yitzchak is your child. That's your future. And he's never said it before. It's almost as if this smile of Ishmael creates that. Up until now, God hasn't said that. By the smile, Ishmael deprives himself of becoming part of Avraham's future. Arrogance. What was it that Amalek had? The cynicism. Remember Amalek? There's no, with Amalek, there's no rebuke, there's no education, you cannot educate a cynic. Anything else that Yishmael did, Avram could have repaired. But when Yishmael becomes a cynic, you lose authority. How can Avram teach a young man who says or believes that Avimelech was the father? That completely undermines the status of Avram in the eyes of the son, in a way that, and you can never do anything about it. That's the tragedy of cynicism. You can never deal with it. You can never eradicate it. You can never, because it permeates everything that is said and everything that is done. That smile makes it impossible for Ishmael to continue to gain from Avram, and therefore he needs to go, and he needs his mother to go with him. And Hagar goes because Ishmael has to go, not of anything in her own right. There's no cure for cynicism. No, unless the person cures himself. The only thing is that he can. But each person has a different thing. He experiences suffering or hardship or sees something or matures or whatever it is. And so it is, and Linda's comment ties into that, because what do? We do nothing about it. We don't actually deal with it. We wait for the child to grow out of it and for him to cure himself of it. If you try and keep on dealing with it, you'll lose it completely. And that's why, in that situation, isn't she sees, and that's why Avram is willing to delay it. Why is Avram willing to delay it? Exactly, I'm a parent of a teenager. And although I haven't had a teenager child before, I've been in the people business for a long time, and I know teenagers. And God says, not this one, you don't know. This one you need prophecy to know. And and that Sarah has gotten. We learn from here that Sarah was the greater prophet. When God says, you're missing something that she can see, and it's a matter of seeing into the future, that she's able to see that this isn't a temporary smoke, this is wickedness. And this smoke will never come off that face, not for thousands of years. And she sees that.
Sharon. Has not been involved in Ishmael's development. Here he's been in the house. For 13, 15 years he's been raised.
On the first part, that is the reason that some authorities in the Gemara itself reject those views, to say that it's not possible if it was idolatry. And there are ways of resolving that, which I won't get into now, that it doesn't mean heavy idolatry and heavy. It means subtle, just subtle manifestations of a tendency towards those things. And the smirk, it's a difficult thing to see very often, and it's a difficult thing to deal with, certainly from somebody who isn't his mother.
Hagar
must have been the one who was. Sarah might have been to some degree.
She literally gave her maidservant to her husband. For a child, that she wouldn't have almost tried to take that child in and
really
raise that child after
her own. Yeah, that probably is part of it, that the family relationships, the dynamics were just too split, that it wasn't feasible, and that's why it didn't work out the way that she'd hoped for, maybe. But there doesn't seem to be an indication that she was just, Avraham certainly invested in Ishmael, and that's why it was very hard for him to let him go. But even with all that investment, that cynicism is something that a person can develop, and And then unless he gets rid of it himself, there's nothing an educator can do. He's uneducatable.
It seems that what we
should
do,
That's probably why Hagar is somewhat to blame for it, that for those 2 years she should have been preparing him to play his part in the palace. You're not going to be you're not the crown prince, but you're a prince. And there's a role. Hagar thought she was. Okay, but right through that's been the problem. Sarah not accepting that, Hagar taking a view of herself as more important than she is, that going down to Ishmael. Now Yitzchak comes into the picture, and clearly this party establishes him as the crown prince, and he has not been prepared for that. That he has been prepared to compete, even if not deliberately, subconsciously. His relationship to Yitzchak at this party indicates to Soro that he has been prepared to compete. And competition is okay, but then outside the house. We'll deal with you then as an outside competitor. You can't have your competitor inside your business. You can't have your competitor inside your home. If you're here to support, we can build a home. If you're here to compete, you're going to have to do it on your own. And that's her approach.
It sounds like the person who is sent to get out.
Go and establish your identity elsewhere. And Avraham gives them money, and he establishes them, and he helps them to establish their identity elsewhere. And she's saying, I'm not interested where they go, but not in my home. If there's going to be a competitive element there, that's fine. If that's God's will, that's also fine. But I'm not going to deal with that. Yeah, it's hard enough to educate Yitzchak as it is, but it's still educating with a sibling who's undermining what I'm teaching. That's not going to be feasible. It's
we needed her to talk to God before he caused all this problem.
Jamil, I think we did together a piece of Ramban that blamed Sarah for the rise of the Arab nation by rejecting Hagar, and that this is almost God decided then that Hagar is going to be a force in the world. She merits this. Hagar is going to have a nation just as Avraham has a nation. Ideally, they should have shared in the same nation, or in two nations very closely related, as the two nations are closely related. But that wasn't to be, and the Ramban blames Sarah's relationship to Hagar for that divergence of the nations. So that's almost predetermined that he's going to be that because he's Abraham's son. As God says to him, because he's your son, he will have a great nation. But further, in the next sentences, which we don't have time to get on to, he nearly dies, and God miraculously supplies water. And the angels say, God, come on. Just don't do anything. Just leave him alone. Not only are you supplying water to an Arab, but this particular Arab is going to cause your people to die of thirst. There was a time later on in Tanakh when they gave them deliberately, the Jews were thirsty. It was like the liberation from the concentration camp. And they gave them salty food, these Arabs, descendants of Ishmael, so that they would want water, and that would cause their intestines to burst, and that would kill them in a horrible way. That's the same people. Why are you giving him water? And God answers, because that sin there's no trace of in Ishmael's character at the moment. And therefore, I judge him where he is now, not where he's going to be. If a person is good now, the fact that he might go off later on doesn't affect the way I judge him now. For the cynicism. They do get nothing to do, not only to do with you. You are part of a chain. Okay, and the result of that, he's out of Avraham's house. The result of that, he's an Arab. Instead of being a Jew, he's an Arab. If you can look at two nations that are the opposite of achievement and lack of achievement, of dignity and lack of dignity, till this day, you're looking at the Jews and the Arabs. And that's his punishment. He loses his dignity. They're not dignified in the world. They're not. Even people who hate the Jews hate the Arabs too. Nobody loves the Arabs. There's nobody in the whole world that really likes them. That's why God gave them oil. Because if they didn't have oil, nobody would take any notice of them at all. The only reason they have any say in the world is because they've got oil. Otherwise, they would be completely isolated. So they've suffered a terrible lot by being cast out of Avraham's life. They got the oil, that's true, but they lost their dignity. The Jews lost the oil, but they gained the dignity. But you're right, that one can benefit from great parents, grandparents, great grandparents. Sure, one can. There is such a thing. We are a time frame in a long chain, and just as in a stage of your life, you might be treated well because even though you're doing something wrong, because you did something so good up until that stage, and God helps that see you over it. So you've got to see an individual as a stage in a long life that goes beyond his own lifespan. We are a window of time in a long chain in which we only form one part. So history didn't start the day we were born. Our own history started generations and generations ago. And just as we accumulate wealth, and that wealth is passed down from parent to child, so we accumulate good qualities and we accumulate merits, and a lot of that is passed down and gives certain children a start that others don't have. Is that fair to the child? No, but is it fair to the complete string of the family? Yes. The reward is not always in one generation. That does come into it. And there's no question that Yishmael benefits from being Avraham's son. That he suffers the impact of the cynicism in that, although he's Avraham's son, he's not part of Avraham's household. Quran, yes. Avraham remarries her. Yeah, we'll come to that. No. Yishmael's by that time gone off and done his own thing. Yeah.
If Sarah was a great prophet, but she couldn't see that if she gave Hagar to her husband, that would result in a bad son.
Yeah, a prophet doesn't see everything all the time. A prophet sees those things that God gives him to see. So there are times when a prophet is not having prophecy, and then he's just an ordinary human being. He just sees the same as anybody else can see. But in this case, at these moments, she was able to see into the future in a way that Abraham was not. That's clear. That's what I was saying. When the Ramban talks about Sarah having created that in that she was creating these two forces. By doing what she did with Hagar, an incredibly powerful person, she was creating two forces coming from Abraham. So Abraham now spawns a Sarah-initiated nation and a Hagar-initiated nation. And sure, they're going to be at loggerheads because they're two different value systems, and yet there's something common. There was an interesting interview recently with this new president in Indonesia, because there's been a lot of ethnic problems with the Chinese, and he's asked some very pointed questions, and he talks about that he believes in God, and actually says, and therefore there's no difference between us Christians and Jews. We're Muslims, Christians, Jews, we all believe in one God. So the Christians, though, believe that he has a human form, so really I've got a lot more in common with Jews. And when I travel, I look for kosher restaurants, and I eat in kosher restaurants, and then I know that I'm okay. Interesting that he feels theologically much more comfortable with Jews, as do all Muslims. Feel more theologically comfortable with Jews, and yet the hatred and the enmity and the jealousies are much greater with Jews. So it's this very strange dichotomous relationship that we have with the Bnei Yishmael. They're our cousins, and yet there's such a funny kind of competitiveness that there isn't really competition, we're in different fields, and yet it is. There's a desire for total destruction. A very, very strange relationship, and this is its origin.